Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question, how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Dr. Gil Blander. Welcome to our first ever in-person recording of Longevity by Design, How to Live Healthier, Longer Life. We are produced by Inside Tracker, your science-based guide to optimize your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. René Dehaene. René is the Vice President of Science and Artificial Intelligence at Inside Tracker. René holds a doctoral degree in molecular and cellular biology from the University of California, Berkeley. René is a molecular biologist by training and has spent the last decade guiding drug discovery and biomarker development by designing and building a high-resolution molecular models of disease and creating systems that find meaning in large-scale biological data. I know René for more than 15 years, and we actually used to work together from 2007 in the same company. And our first project was a project that we worked on with a company called Sirtris, which is a company that David Sinclair started. So we know and work on longevity for more than 15 years, which is a lot of fun. And it's also a lot of fun to work with René on and off in the last 15 years. So René, welcome to the show. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you. It is a great pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Usually we start with a question to our audience about your history, long-term history, and more interestingly, why have you decided to become a scientist and not any other profession?
Yeah, it's a great question, one I love, and my guess is that my answer is probably pretty similar to yours, which is, you know, I've always been totally fascinated by the natural world. The world around us. So we live in a network and a system. Our cells are made up of networks. People are networks. You know, we interact with our environment. The Earth is, you know, part of a network within the universe, right? So studying what are the entities within this big kind of cosmic web and their relationship to each other, it has always just been interesting. But in terms of the type of scientist I was, I could have been a physicist, I could have been a geologist. I mean, I literally would like reincarnation to actually be real. I would like to believe in it because I think I could be a different type of scientist for an infinite number of lifetimes.
So the subject of the discussion today is women health. And would like to hear from you, what is the definition of women health and what does it include?
Sure. So let's see. Let's first talk about women in general. So the conversation that we'll have will be relevant to people with ovaries, regardless of what their gender is, or to, in some cases, especially as we're talking about fluctuations in, you know, female-driven hormones, if you are taking gender-affirming therapies, with things like estradiol in them, then some of the symptoms and the impacts that we're talking about could be relevant to you as well. For example, if you're a trans woman.
Okay. So basically everyone that ever has a ovary is a woman. Okay. That's a good definition. And both of us know, we are scientists for a few decades already, that when there is an experiment or when there is a clinical trial, usually women are underrepresented. And can you explain to audience why is it and what is the way to change it?
Sure. I love this question too, and I think it's super important. I think first and foremost, women have not been at the decision-making table. And, you know, that means we've been underrepresented in terms of the medical field, the number of physicians that there are out there. I think a really important one is funding. So haven't been at the table making decisions about where funding dollars have been spent. And of course, this is definitely getting better. We're not quite there yet. But I think that, honestly, the root of the problem is an economic one in women when they are at the table and deciding where the money goes and who has the money. This is certainly it. There are some practical elements to this as well. So back in 1977, the FDA had guidelines that recommended that any woman of childbearing potential be excluded from clinical trials. They were worried, they were concerned about things like what happened with thalidomide. So women who were pregnant were given thalidomide for morning sickness, and then it had disastrous consequences on people that took thalidomide, on children that were born and exposed to thalidomide. And so this in part was an effort to mitigate disasters like that. But what it meant was that then women weren't studied as much in clinical trials. And another element to this is oftentimes the woman's monthly cycle or these fluctuations that do occur in hormones in women were considered to be confounding effects. And, you know, that's been a real challenge because it means that we just know less about the biology of women than we do about men. And, you know, an example of some consequences of this are that women are twice as likely to experience adverse events from drugs as men are because of that. And it's not just because women are smaller and we're giving them too much of something, but in lots of different drugs, it's what's called PK parameters are different. PK stands for pharmacokinetics, and it's really how a person or an individual metabolizes drugs. And in many drugs, women might hang on to that drug for longer. It may interact with different tissues. And if that's not known during the drug discovery and development process, and then it's given to women, it just at like a lower dose, it doesn't necessarily mitigate all of the side effects. So if people have shown that for women that actually do have extenuating PK parameters for a drug, the chances of having an adverse event to that drug are actually much higher.
So how can we fix it?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, we can definitely get more women at the table and making those funding decisions. I think that, you know, let's start at the top. But also, you know, I think education is wonderful, right? Like, I think it's great for men to know about this. It's great for women to know about this. And you can't really solve a problem until you've defined it and you know what it is. So I think that knowledge is power here for sure.
Cool, thank you, and hopefully everyone that is listening, try to promote as many women as possible to a key position, and hopefully we'll have a better outcome and a better trials that will allow us to treat women at least in the same level that we are treating males. And in this regard, a follow-up question is, why women health is important, or why should a male care about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's just reasons of humanity. I'm a woman. I care a lot about men's health because there are a lot of men in my life that I love, and I don't want to see them suffer, and I want to see them have their basic needs met. And I think we all believe that healthcare is a basic need. So there's that. And rising tide raises all ships type of mentality. I think the more we learn about women, the more we learn about men. And, you know, you and I both come from a personalized medicine background, right? So, you know, men and women, it's not even just a binary, but the more we know about that kind of like spectrum of sex, that means we understand more about biology, which means we understand about, you know, symptoms and drugs and diseases and pathology. So there's that. But there are also economic reasons. So women make up 50% of the population, 50% of the workforce. And that's really just talking about paid work, you know, not even thinking about unpaid work like caregiving. So if women are less healthy, then they are less able to caregive. They are less able to work. And that's even outside of suffering. So the RAND Corporation actually did a really interesting simulation. It was an economic simulation where they took the NIH budget for women's health funding and they doubled it. And then they assumed very, very modest improvements in health outcomes for women. And what they came up with was that if you made that investment, you would see a 9,500% return on that investment. So, you know, economically, why aren't we doing this? Even as a government, why aren't we doing this just for purely market capitalism reasons?
Absolutely. I think that's a great cause. And I want to add that every male has at least a mother, if not a spouse, if not a kids, and some of them are women. So all of us should care about it. It doesn't matter what is your gender. So absolutely agree with you. And I think that, Rene, recently you and your team at Insight Tracker built a new panel or headed some blood biomarkers that actually will help women to not only to feel better, but to understand the body better and then hopefully trying to close the gap that we just discussed before. Can you elaborate a bit about the panel that you headed? What are the biomarkers? Why have you decided to add them and so on?
Yeah, sure. So we added three different biomarkers to the panel. There's estradiol, which is one of three estrogens that is produced by the body. It is produced by the adrenal glands, but mostly the ovaries, but also fat. Fat is a hormonal tissue. So that's one. Another one is progesterone, which is really important for regulating the menstrual cycle, mood, establishing and maintaining pregnancy. And that's also produced by the ovaries, most notably the corpus luteum, as well as the adrenal glands. And then we also added thyroid-stimulating hormone, which is a marker of your thyroid health and metabolic health. And what thyroid-stimulating hormone does is it's produced by the pituitary, and it basically tells the thyroid what to do. And the thyroid will pump out two different important hormones, T3 and T4, that, you know, leave the thyroid and go on and influence other metabolic effects in the body and regulate the body temperature. And so thyroid-stimulating hormone is actually a negative regulator of T3 and T4. And so that means that when levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone, and we can just call it TSH, when levels of TSH are low, then levels of T3 and T4 will be high and vice versa. So it's really acting like a sensor in your thermostat. And if the temperature outside, if you like it at 70 degrees in your house or 68 and the temperature is 110, then it's going to, you know, tell the radiator to turn off. And if it's 2 degrees out, then it will kick on the heat.
Excellent. Thank you so much for the background. Let's try to zoom in into each of them. And let's start with the TSH. So, and specifically for the thyroid. So it's well known that women are suffering more from irregularity of the thyroid. Can you explain why, if it's known, and also what is the magnitude of the overrepresentation of thyroid issue with women versus males?
Yeah, so I think women are 5 to 8 times more likely to suffer from thyroid disease. Though, you know, we should say that thyroid disease is highly prevalent in the United States. I think 20 million Americans are suffering from thyroid disease, although 60% of them exhibit no symptoms. Oftentimes, it is an incidental finding. And I can tell you, actually, I don't have a thyroid. So I have thyroid disease, obviously. If I don't have one, you cannot live without a thyroid at all. It is absolutely impossible. But it was an incidental finding. My PCP actually figured it out some years ago. And what happened was I was born with only half of a thyroid. So it's this butterfly-shaped organ right here, and I only had half of it. And actually, the other half of it developed a benign tumor, and that benign tumor was actually pumping out a ton of T3 and T4. So I was in what's called a hyperthyroid state. And, you know, we decided at that point to have surgery, remove the thyroid, and now I take levothyroxine, which is a T4 analog. And it's fine. You know, it's you know, so far it's fine. But what was really interesting was that, first of all, I had no idea it was an incidental finding. But once it was brought to my attention, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I have been eating a lot lately and not really gaining any weight. So that's kind of the metabolic regulation aspect to it. And I remember thinking, like, is this a bad thing? Am I getting away with murder here? And you know, my endocrinologist was like, it is. So you really don't want to be in a hyperthyroid state for too long. It can increase your risk for cardiovascular disease. It can affect your bones and precipitate osteoporosis. So, you know, we really wanted to fix that problem. And it has been fixed. But oftentimes people can also be hypothyroid, which means you're not pumping out enough T3 and T4. And when you're hypothyroid, you might have other challenges with cold temperature regulation. You might be gaining weight. You might have more of a depressed mood. But what was pretty cool, too, was that at the time I was wearing an Apple Watch. And I went back and I looked at my resting heart rate. And you could actually see it slowly elevating from, you know, what's my baseline around low 50s, you know, up to almost 70.
Wow.
Yeah. And I hadn't actually noticed it until it was sort of pointed out to me. Mm. But yeah, so that would be for thyroid yeah, disease.
Excellent. So I think that's a very good example of why do we need to test and how much knowledge is a power. And as René said before, I don't remember exactly, but around 50% of the not only women, people that have a thyroid issue don't know about it.
Yep.
So the best way to do is to screen. And again, you can screen with your physician, go to your physician and ask him or her to do the test. But if you want to, you can come. And right now, InstaTracker have added this TSH, not only for women, actually also for males, mm-hmm. because it's an important issue, not only for women. So I think that's a very good example. Thank you so much for sharing this, let's say, very personal information with us and with our audience. Really appreciate that. And maybe let's switch gear to the two hormones that are more like related to women health. And with them, it will be also interesting to zoom in into the phases of the women life. And as all of us know, the women life is a bit more complex than males. We are born and die and we're the same, more or less. For women, you have a few different stages. You have the premenopausal, then the perimenopausal, and then the postmenopausal. So it will be interesting, if you can, to share a bit about those two hormones and how do they behave and what is the importance of them in each of those stages.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just define the stages first. So we have the premenopausal stage, and that's, you know, a girl may enter menarche somewhere in her early teens, you know, on average, and then, you know, they start getting their period, and there'll be a regular or an irregular cycle for some amount of years until menopause occurs. Most often, I think the average age is around 51, so women in their early 50s, although it can definitely happen earlier because of either, I'd say, like genetic reasons or chemical reasons. So, for example, lots of different cancer therapies actually may kick you into an early menopause. So, but when that happens, you have estradiol and progesterone. And estradiol is the most kind of prominent, the strongest of the estrogens. And what that does is during the menstrual phase, when you are premenstrual and you are cycling, then the menstrual cycle really has like two phases and an exciting event in the middle of those two phases. There's the follicular phase, which is the first half, and then there's the luteal phase, which is the second half, and right in between there is ovulation. And during the follicular phase, right at the beginning, estrogen and progesterone are actually both very low. And then estrogen will start to rise, and then along with two other hormones, luteinizing hormone and FSH, those will kind of spike around ovulation or right before ovulation. It tells the ovary to release that egg. And then after that, you enter the luteal phase and estrogen starts to wane, but progesterone starts to increase until the end of the cycle, when both estrogen and progesterone, you know, go back down to their baseline low levels. And that's when menstruation happens. So that's kind of the estrogen-progesterone cycle from within the phase. And then at perimenopause, which is the period of time before menopause, and menopause is really just a day in a woman's life, and that is her last period. And it's clinically defined as, you know, you're in menopause when you haven't had a period for 12 consecutive months. But before that, progesterone and estrogen are going up and down and up and down, and you may start experiencing a lot of the, like, quote-unquote symptoms of perimenopause and menopause. So things like hot flashes, things like a distribution in of fat around your body. There could be mood changes. There could be cognitive effects. There are other, you know, internal things, like you could begin losing muscle, bone mineral density decreases, and so your risk of osteoporosis increases. I'm trying to think of what else I'm forgetting, but there is a whole host. But that, all of those things happen because of these real fluctuations that occur during perimenopause. Your periods may become much more irregular during that period of time. And really what's happening is that you're, you know, you release one egg per month on average, until you start to reach the end of your egg reserves. And that's what's going on in perimenopause. Now, at the same time, you know, LH and FSH actually rise during that period. So when you're postmenopausal, oftentimes LH and FSH are going to be high. And then after menopause, progesterone and estradiol are going to be low. So it kind of, you know, cycles for some years, gets a little wonky for a while during perimenopause, and then kind of levels out after menopause, and progesterone and estradiol stay low.
Excellent. Thank you so much for this explanation. And a couple of comments. First, we hosted here in Longevity by Design a few months ago, Professor Jennifer
Garrison.
Jennifer G. Garrison from the Buck Institute. And she came with a very interesting information that I didn't know, that there is a strong correlation between when you enter into menopause and your longevity. So basically, if your menopause is earlier, you most likely live shorter, while someone that the menopause is later. So I think that that's an interesting a piece of information. When I asked her why, she said, most likely the ovary is the first, is the fastest aging organ in the women body. And that's actually can give us some hint about what will happen later with other organs. Another interesting point is, Rene, you and I had a discussion a couple of days ago about another cause of, let's call it artificial menopause, when young women, especially pro athletes that are exercising a lot and have a very little amount of fat reserve, they're actually getting into an artificial menopause that they can get out of it while they are consuming more food. So what I'm trying to say here for young women is, when you are exercising or become a pro athlete, it's you have a lot of benefits, but also think about your health, because when you get to this, let's call it again, artificial menopause, you might it might be hard for you to get out of it. So be careful and don't be very, very skinny, because to create those hormones, you need some fat. So those are two points that I wanted to add. And then I want to ask you the next question is, Why is it so important to test those two hormones, the progesterone and the estradiol? And also, it sounds like it's very complex because it's changing all the time. So when are we going to catch the right time to test?
So I'm a little obsessed with this because, like, just maybe full disclosure here, I am 46. I am definitely in perimenopause. And I started getting hot flashes it was before COVID, so I was probably about 42. And my mom passed away, almost 9 years ago. So I can't ask her these questions. So actually, like, PSA out there to all women, especially if you've not experienced menopause or perimenopause yet, there's really an opportunity to go and talk to the women that you are biologically related to. If you know who those people are, you might be adopted and then it's hard to know. But I would totally, like, I wish that I could ask my mom a whole bunch of questions and all I really have is my memory. But I do know that my mom was in her early 50s when it happened. And a real question to me is, like, why did this start literally a decade earlier than my mom? And, you know, like, am I doing something wrong? Is it my thyroid problems? I asked my endocrinologist. He was like, no, chill. But I actually just texted my cousin and I was like, hey, how about you? And how about your mom, who's my dad's twin? I was like, what is going on with menopause on dad's side of the family? And she told me that my aunt, first aunt, she went through menopause at 40.
Wow.
So I was like, oh, this is why I'm splitting the difference here. And one of the things that I'm super excited about, and that, as you know, we're working on with Bartek, who heads up our genomics group, is an age at menopause polygenic score. And I am dying to know, you know, does that score kind of reflect the splitting the difference? So, you know, hopefully, and I think about, like, folks who are adopted all the time and can't go and get a family history, like a family medical history. But, you know, hopefully, you know, we can illuminate more of their ancestry and their disease risk and phenotypic risks with genomics to be able to, you know, give them a clue as to, like, what is kind of the baseline? How is your genetic sequence contributing to your scenario? So I actually don't remember what the explained variance is for that score. I don't know if you do, but I'm excited.
No, I'm not. And actually, it's a question that I want to ask you later. So first, thank you so much again for sharing a very personal information. I think that it's a great example for our audience. Nobody should be ashamed or shy, and again, if you don't want to share it, that's okay, but it's good, it's great to share your information, talk with others, all is medical, and people are good. My philosophy that everyone is a good person, and if you share information, you might get more value from the information that you shared, and sounds like, Rene, you have the same philosophy, so that's great. I want to go back to the question about the estradiol and the progesterone. About first, let's start with, why is it important to test them?
Yeah, and it's, you know, having too much or too little of something can always be a challenge. And these hormones, and, you know, it's not untrue in the male body either. Just hormones in general they're regulating a lot of systemic functions within the body. And they are doing so in this, like, precise balance. And when they're out of whack, then things can go haywire, like what happened with my thyroid and being hyperthyroid. So understanding where your hormones are over time is really important. I wish that, for example, if I had sort of been regularly testing my TSH, I would have figured out my thyroid problem earlier, right? And I don't know for how many years was I living in a hyperthyroid state. I don't know what the impact is on my risk for cardiovascular disease because of when my untreated hyperthyroidism, right? I worry about that. I worry about the fact that I'm probably going to enter menopause earlier, on the earlier side for women. And what does that mean for my, you know, my risk of disease, because we, as we know, the risk of disease always changes. So having an idea where your hormones are is always helpful. And some of these things are challenging, right? Like I just said that estrogen and progesterone fluctuate throughout the month, right? So, you know, for women who, it's good to know when your last menstrual period is, because that can help us interpret your progesterone and estradiol levels. But also how does this change over time? And, you know, people have looked at things like after menopause, it's not like all of your estradiol goes away. It's vastly decreased. But I think that there's been, you know, kind of positive connections between disease risk, longevity, and higher levels of estradiol after menopause. Somebody should fact check me on this. But I think that, you know, having that information is really important. So, like, I'll never shut up about biomarker testing and understanding, like, where is your baseline? You need something to compare it to, because that information is really useful to yourself, to your doctor, all of that.
Yeah, I would echo that. And I think that it's super important for humanity. And there is not a lot of databases that measuring it, especially in, I call the INSA tracker a society or revolution, a free range human. So it's not like a sick population. It's a people that in the wild, not in the lab, and doing whatever they are doing. And I think that we need to know what happened in their body. And I think that it can help a lot for us. It's also an important a way for you as a woman to know what is my baseline. And then if you measure again and again and again, and suddenly it's going too high or too low, and you are measuring in the right time, then you can understand that something changed, and it will be a good time for you to go to the health provider, discuss it with him or her, and try to understand what is going on in your body. So it's definitely a great way for you, if you want to live better longer, is to understand your body and find the time that something changed and react fast and be proactive and not reactive, like what happened today in the healthcare system, which... we can discuss it for 10 hours. But I want also to add the analogy for males. And for males, everyone knows it's testosterone. And in INSA tracker, we have tens of thousands of males that tested with testosterone. And if I recall correctly, we have tens of percentage, maybe 30% of the males that have been tested with INSA tracker, that their testosterone was too low. And they didn't know that, and that can reflect a lot of issue in your life. So just finding the issue is the beginning of the solution. Definitely INSA tracker can give you the recommendations. So it's no brainer to test, and I really encourage everyone to test. Again, if you want, do it with INSA tracker. We'll love it. It will help us to make the world better. But if you want to, go to your physician, explain to him or her that you want to know, and hopefully they will provide it to you. So thank you so much for that, Renee. The next question is, you started to discuss it with the age of menopause and the genetics. So what is the role of genetics in this process at a high level? Like, for example, there is a disease like PCOS or other issues that women have. Is it genetics, or it's more environment or behavior? Can you elaborate a bit about that?
Yeah, and you know, as you know as well as I, it's usually both. And with one of the things that I like a lot about genetics and clinical lab values is they are things that are very well studied. So there's a lot of what we would call prior knowledge that exists out there about them. So you know, there are people have published papers, and we can go read about the impact of a particular variation in somebody's genome and the impact on estradiol synthesis, or their risk for PCOS, you know, their risk for type 2 diabetes mellitus. And I think, you know, so, but it really depends on the genomic trait that you're looking at, how heritable it is. And how complex that trait is. So, for example, I know that we are working on our polygenic score for ApoB. And that is, I think it's measuring tens of thousands of areas of the genome, different single nucleotide polymorphisms, but that's a really complex trait. And so it really does depend, but we know that, I can give another example that I think is actually pretty key. So I have a family history of, high cholesterol on one side of my family. And I think, you know, my mom was on a statin, my grandmother is on a statin, so I knew this, and I happened to ask my doctor about it in my 20s, right? And I said, look, my family's on statins. Like, should I get a lipid test? And I was like, there were no other real reasons to do this. And granted, I'm 46 now, so this was a few decades ago. It was hands down one of the most useful pieces of information that I got there. So this is, I'm just going to go off on why it's important to know these things if you want to. I know other people are like, I'd rather not know. And that's cool too. Whatever your jam is. But if you do like to know, if you want to be in the know, I think start early, because I had that cholesterol test and I found out that my cholesterol was high. My LDL cholesterol was high. My HDL was a little low. Like, my lipid profile was not awesome. I think it was around 130. And that's been helpful because I have tried to make dietary interventions, and many of them from Inside Tracker, right? Like, I've added in flax meal and I consume more olive oil and I exercise. And honestly, I just met with a preventative cardiologist because I am in this perimenopause, menopause phase. And I'm like, is now the time that I need to go on a statin? And the answer is yes. You know, she's like, it would have been cool if you wanted to wait a couple of years, but I didn't want to, because one of the things that we know about menopause is that estradiol does have a cardioprotective effect. And women, their LDL cholesterol tends to rise after menopause. And I was already high enough. And I already knew that I was doing everything that I could from a lifestyle perspective. So I knew that, like, knowing that my LDL cholesterol was high in my 20s was so key, because two things. Number one, I knew that, okay, there's some family stuff going on, which could be detected at a genetics level as well, number one. So I don't necessarily feel like it's my fault, and I don't have to feel like I'm not consuming enough olive oil, or I, like, really need to go on a restrictive diet, because at some point it's not going to drop my cholesterol 50 points. But the second thing is that when I saw this preventative cardiologist, which actually I can thank Inside Tracker for, because it was the ApoB test, that was like, I was like, this is the final straw. My ApoB is out of range and menopause is happening and I need to sort this out immediately. And so my primary care sent me to a women's cardiologist that specifically works on preventative cardiology for women. So these people exist. Like, go talk to your doctor about them. It was amazing. And she actually looked at my bloods for the last few decades, including a lot of measurements from Inside Tracker as well. And she's like, I can see over the last couple of years, there's a pattern here. There's a real trend. And she specifically said it was really helpful to see that trend, and especially that trend kind of curving up, and then having that conversation with her about, like, what was I already doing? And that's what led to the decision to go on a statin. And so, you know, we're not recommending that people do or do not go on statins. We're saying, like, go talk to your doctor about this. It's complex biology. Things happen during menopause that may not have been happening 10 years ago. But, like, if you know where you are in your 20s and 30s, then when things get weird in your 40s, you know that they're getting weird and it might be time to jump on that grenade.
Yeah, absolutely. A great example. And again, thank you so much for sharing your personal information. And yeah, I want to say that related to intervention, I think that a good example, when I started Inside Tracker, I realized that I had a very low vitamin D. So I said, okay, let's try to do it naturally. And I literally cook fish for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for a month or so. My house was really stinky from the smell of the fish. And then I test again and it didn't move the needle. So I said, okay, I have to take supplements. So you done the same.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a good lesson for our audience. lifestyle can do a lot, but it cannot do everything. And we have a very good healthcare system that know how to fix you when you're broken. So try with lifestyle, but don't fight. And if you see that you cannot do it, it's okay to take statin. There is a lot of data in the literature that mm-hmm. statin is one of the wonder drugs that we have. And that can add a few decades for your life, so why not? But again, don't take it if you don't need it. And if you tried and you couldn't beat your genes, so do that, what you can do. And I have the same issue, by the way. I have a polygenetic score for high LDL, and I tried everything that I could. And at the end of the day, I said, okay, I'll start taking a statin. And I would recommend everyone else, if you tried the lifestyle and didn't work, and by the way, do the genetic test and see if it's genetics or not. And if it is genetic, maybe you cannot beat your odds. And statin is okay. It's okay to take a drug if you need it.
As a Longevity by Design podcast listener, you understand the value of improving your health for today and for all the years ahead. And if you want to live your healthiest, longest life possible, you need to understand what's going on inside. At Inside Tracker, we take a personalized approach to health span optimization that eliminates guesswork from your wellness plan. Inside Tracker analyzes blood biomarker and DNA data, along with physiomarker data from fitness trackers like Oura Ring, to deliver personalized food, supplement, lifestyle, and exercise recommendations that allow you to take control and improve your health span. And for a limited time, Longevity by Design listeners can get 20% off at the Inside Tracker store. So if you're ready to receive a personal health analysis and data-driven wellness plan to optimize your body for the long haul, then it's time to start inside. Visit insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today. That's insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today.
Now, I want to maybe deep dive a bit more into those a few different stage in the life of the women. And let's try to talk about something that usually it's less discussed in the world, and that's the perimenopause and a postmenopausal women. And specifically, what are the symptoms? What are the issues? What is different between young women like you that have started transition? There are a lot of changes, and I think that it's again, I never had it. I assume that it's scary. Suddenly, your body is really changing, and it's not easy. So, can you describe what happening in the body? What are the a phenotype that you see in and what are the maybe the tool to mitigate it and to make maybe a lemonade from the lemon?
Right. Yeah, great. I mean, who the heck really knows what menopause is? Like, I mean, it's actually pretty amazing how little it is talked about. It sort of blows my mind. And like, I'm a scientist, and I still had to learn a ton about menopause, and trust me, I still am. And like, everybody knows about puberty, right? But nobody seems to know about menopause, unless you're in it. And then, you know, you kind of get schooled really fast. And it's funny, I was having dinner with two friends of mine, and one of them was just like, you know, it's happening. I can feel myself gaining weight. And, you know, this woman has just been super fit all of her life. Like, she teaches spinning classes, and she's like, all of a sudden, like, I can't manage what's going on. And she was saying what she really wanted out of her doctor. She was like, I really want my doctor to just like get in it with me, you know, and it feels like it's not happening. So like, but she just wants that guidance. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I think women need probably more handholding through this entire transition, which frankly can take a really long time. Like, you can be going through this for a decade. Like I said, I'm 46 now. I started having hot flashes at 42. And actually, when I first started having them, I thought that I had leukemia. I mean, I just immediately went to like, clearly I'm dying. And then my doctor was like, I think it's menopause. You're fine. We'll do a CBC on you anyway. But I love my doctor. So, but it's a real thing. So I'm really glad that we're studying it. I'm really glad that we're talking about it. I like want men to know about it. I want women to know about it. I actually like need to go ask my kids if they're learning. They should be teaching menopause in health class. Like, why aren't they doing that? Like my 13-year-old son should understand what menopause is. I should go tell him if he doesn't already. But anyway, so in terms of the symptoms, like there can be a lot going on. So the vast majority of women will experience symptoms. I think it's like 80%. And the severity of those symptoms and the number of those symptoms that a person experiences obviously is as individual as four people in the same household get COVID and it manifests itself differently in terms of symptoms, right? So biggies are hot flashes. Like I mentioned, that redistribution of fat. So, you know, typically, you know, women will have and carry more fat around their, you know, their hips, right? But this fat starts to like change and be less focused on the hips and more focused on the belly. And that's associated with a decline in estrogen. Cognitive, like brain fog, right? One of the other things that can happen is changes in mood imbalances. So maybe experiencing symptoms of depression, maybe experiencing symptoms of anxiety. And I'm trying to think what else, sleep disturbances for sure. And, you know, if you imagine you're waking up in the middle of the night cause you're having a hot flash, right? So things like that can happen. Not sure. I'm sure I'm missing some of them, but you know, I also have to say that it is, I haven't noticed a lot of these myself. Hot flashes for sure. Some of the other stuff, like maybe it's coming for me. I don't really know. But honestly, it was one of the reasons why I think my doctor, when I was 42, had offered me, hormone replacement therapy, which I think is now called menopause hormone therapy, MHT. And I said no, because I was like, eh, it's not that bad. Like, it's not that bad. But I actually just made an appointment with her to go talk about it more for the potential cardioprotective and, you know, benefits for health span, right? But for a lot of women, these symptoms are wild and they massively disrupt their life. And they not like, I don't know the statistic, but I was listening to this menopause expert the other day, and she's from the UK, and she was talking about how it's really disrupted the workforce. And like lots of women have had to leave their jobs or take pauses in their jobs to deal with their menopause symptoms. And that's wild, right? So it's kind of like an epidemic.
No, it's crazy. Yeah.
And
I remember one day, it happened before you joined the company, Rene. We were traveling to New York to meet with a collaborator. And I remember in the team of the collaborator, there was a woman that I assumed that she faced the transition. And she basically stand next to refrigerator and open and close it just to get the cool of the refrigerator. And it's really tough. Suddenly your body is changing. It's not easy. And I think that the first thing that we need to do is to educate and to know, and then try to find a way to mitigate it. And I just want to add that due to going into the those women-related markers, InstaTracker developed a lot of resource blogs and some other interviews, and the other one of them is a panel that Rene, you interviewed a leader in the field of women health that I would highly recommend everyone to listen to. I think that there is a lack of information, and I think that the information is important. And then start with information, then go into understand yourself and what is your level. Have a baseline if you are very young. If you are not, start the baseline. The best day to do the baseline is today, not tomorrow. So if you started at the 40, that's okay. If you started at the 20, it's better, but we cannot go back in life, not yet, hopefully in the future. So anyway, that's my 2 cents about that. And a follow-up question to what we discussed about the effect of a menopause is also the relationship for the age-related diseases. So you started to talk about it in cardiovascular diseases, but I'm sure that there is more. Can you elaborate a bit about that? What change in the body of a woman when she transfers from premenopause to perimenopause to menopause? What happened and what are the risks that suddenly she should maybe pay more attention to?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And actually you're reminding me some of the symptoms I forgot to talk about were... like vaginal dryness and urinary incontinence and those are two things that can be mediated by estradiol. So estradiol actually has an important role in skin tone and elasticity. So you'll see, that's where some of these challenges can occur for women. Less of a health risk, but wrinkles as well. So that all has to do with skin elasticity. But beyond, I mean, cardiovascular disease, and that's really looking at heart attacks. And actually we should talk about heart attacks for a moment, because I think this is another great example of some of the differences between men and women and why we actually do need to focus on, you know, women specific research is, so women's risk of cardiovascular disease is lower than men until menopause, right? And then it catches right up. And that's important because cardiovascular disease is actually not a male disease. It is the number one killer of women. 1 in 3 women will die of a cardiovascular related event in our population. So that's huge.
And the symptoms are different, correct?
Yes.
So male, when he get into heart attack, he feels it in the heart. Can you elaborate a bit what happened for women?
Yeah, no, that's it. Like if you ask anybody to like mimic a heart attack, they're going to go like this, right? And that, you know, that can be a symptom for women, but women may also present with like atypical symptoms, and I'm using air quotes here for a reason. So they might present with nausea or dizziness or shortness of breath, right? So women are actually there was a very large study that looked at 2 million people. It was a recent study. And they showed that women were less likely to be prescribed cardiovascular disease-related drugs. So blood pressure, high blood pressure medication, or statins, or baby aspirin. So they were less likely to be, you know, offered those drugs. But like, I think that a lot of people are just not as familiar with the presentation of cardiovascular disease in women as in men, because it just hasn't been well studied enough. And then that knowledge about those differences hasn't, you know, trickled its way out to, you know, even the entirety of the medical community. So, so anyway, I think that's a big one. There's other like your risk of dementia increases after menopause, and women who, and this is kind of getting to Dr. Garrison's point, where women who undergo menopause at around 45 compared to 50 have a 30% increase in their likelihood of developing dementia before the age of 65. So, I mean, just selfishly, I'm freaked out by that, right? I mean, and I actually don't know what the incidence is of developing dementia before 65, but I don't want to enhance my risk of that at all. So just knowing this information, sure, it's a little scary, but, you know, now I can think about like, okay, well, you know, do I need to be paying attention to this? And is there anything that I can do right now? So I think that's another one. Thyroid disease, women, there is an association between becoming hypothyroid and age in general, but also around menopause. So that's another one. So I think around menopause, if you haven't had your TSH tested, good time to just check in with the doc. Is everything going okay there? Because there are a lot of risks that are associated with either being hyper or hypothyroid. Also, it's really important to think about emotional health and mood disorders, right? So depression sucks, anxiety sucks. These are, you know, these are real challenges. And there are tools to be able to cope with anxiety and depression. And, you know, again, there are lifestyle-based tools, but also sometimes it's, you know, lifestyle tools aren't going to be able to manage everything. You just need to go talk to your doctor. But, like, you know, if you find yourself, you know, if you're perimenopausal or menopausal and you find yourself dealing with exacerbated anxiety or depression, like, don't ignore it, you know, go investigate, get curious about it. You know, 'cause you're not crazy, like you're not crazy at all. And it's really, these things are also hard, and this really goes for anybody, but a lot of this can come with, you know, well, I'm really busy and I've got all of these responsibilities. And, you know, maybe that's why I feel so much anxiety, or maybe that's why I'm kind of depressed. It's because I just have too much on my plate. Like, yeah. And maybe it is that, but maybe it's that. And so, you know, yeah.
And I think that that's actually part of the vision of Insight Tracker is, find the issue early and then treat it. So it's much better to come and think that you have an issue and test it and see, hey, it was a false alarm, than to ignore it and then have it as a big issue. So it's definitely a prevention versus a treatment, a disease. So 100% with you and for everyone. If you have an issue and you believe that you have an issue, go and investigate. A lot of it, again, you can find by doing or using a solution like Insight Tracker, but definitely the physician, if you will push him or her enough, they will listen to you and let you receive the right treatment. They are very busy today and they don't have a lot of time, but if you will push enough, they will help you.
Yeah. Can I actually add two things that I forgot to mention earlier? Sarcopenia and osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. Risks of those increase with and after menopause.
Can you elaborate for our audience what is sarcopenia?
Sarcopenia is loss of muscle tissue. So one of the, and this is why it's important for premenopausal women as well, is like, it becomes harder for you to build and maintain muscle mass as you age. And estradiol definitely is involved in that mix, and losing estradiol is like not super helpful. So, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is like if resistance training is the way to build muscle, right? And maintain muscle. So, you know, if you are premenopausal, you can build up your reserves of muscles and make sure that when you get into a perimenopause, menopause state, you go in strong. And, you know, just because you're in your 40s or 50s, 60s, 70s, it doesn't really matter. You can still build muscle. You can absolutely do it. So I love that one. And you know, there's a weird relationship between, I think, like weightlifting and women, right? Whereas, you know, and I can actually totally understand why there are women only gyms, and, you know, some women may not feel super comfortable being in a gym with a whole bunch of guys, but it doesn't really matter. You don't even have to go to the gym. Like, you can have a home gym, you can swim and use water as resistance, but, you know, any type of resistance activity is going to help you build or maintain muscle mass. And that's really important. And along with that, and I know that we sponsor Dr. Lyon, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon's podcast, and she's awesome. And we just talked to her, and she's a big proponent of like making sure that women, especially as they age, are getting enough protein, because you need that protein in order to build and maintain muscle mass. So this is something where you don't need drugs for it. Like, sure, there may be some genetic predispositions to whether you favor type 2 versus type 1 muscle fibers. It doesn't matter. You know, it's a wonderful time to start an exercise program if you haven't, and you don't have to do that perfectly. So that's kind of addressing sarcopenia. Osteoporosis, another one. So this is essentially, you know, your bones are going to become more brittle, which means that, you know, if you take a fall, then your chances of having a real kind of catastrophic break are going to be higher. And we know that for the elderly, a fall can really, it can really precipitate death, yeah. right? So there's a lot of stuff there. So with that, you know, make sure that you get calcium through dairy. Take your vitamin D supplements, make sure you're cool there, you know, get a little bit of sunshine. All of that kind of stuff can really help. But that's another thing is like, you know, in people who you know, can't afford to do this, or if you can get your doctor to kind of give you a DEXA scan, that'll give you some bone density assessments, you know, doing a bone density assessment is really great. You do kind of want to know where you are there. So, and if, even if you don't know, there's plenty of things that you can do on your own to make sure that you're fortifying your bones.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, I'm also a big fan of DEXA scan. And by the way, I done a scan a few weeks ago and I was shocked what is my body fat percentage. And I literally started every diet because of that. So again, knowledge is a power, and we're trying to see how can we integrate DEXA now to InstaTracker, because it's, as Rene said, it's so important. It's look at your body fat percentage. And we heard that women at the menopause and menopause transition starting to change the distribution of the fat and also gaining more fat, and and definitely the bone mineral density is so important, and you need to know. And if you know, again, you can consume more calcium or receive calcium as a supplement. There are a lot of things to do, but first you need to know. And if you don't know and you are ignorant, it's very hard to help you.
So, and it's really visceral fat too, which, you know, it's hard to, I think DEXA might be the only way that you're actually going to get an actual measurement of visceral fat.
Absolutely.
Although you can estimate, and it's certainly correlated with, you know,
waist
subcutaneous size, fat, yeah. right? Yeah. And waist size, exactly.
Yeah. Cool. So, Rene, we spoke a lot about those, let's say, symptoms of the transition and the menopause. Let's go for a second back to our discussion about the new markers that you and your team added, and what is the relation and why those can allow our users, women users, to understand better their body and basically try to fight those changes that are happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're kind of back to like the more you know. So really, if you're out of range on something, then, you know, two things will happen. First of all, you'll know. So then you can go take that information to your doctor and just talk to them. So for example, like the conversation that I'll have about HRT or MHT with my doctor. But the second thing is like in cases where, you know, there are lifestyle changes that, you know, could be made, then we can kind of, at least, you know, that you can start making those changes. So,
okay, great. And I think that you gave a good example, but I want to, zoom into that. And my question is, we are supplying to our users data about blood, and we added a few more markers related to women health. We are supplying data about DNA, and you discussed a bit the score maybe of age of menopause, so women can know when their genetics say that they will go into menopause, and maybe or maybe not, you can fight it, but at least you know the data. But also we have a data about physiological markers. And I think that you gave a good example before about your thyroid and I think that was resting heart rate that went very high and when you looked at your Apple Watch. So can you discuss a bit about that and how triangulating from different direction with data of your blood biomarkers and your DNA data and data from a fitness tracker, how can all of that allow a woman to understand her body better and hopefully live better longer?
Yeah, and you know, I think actually, like if I just look at my own case, it really is the concert of all of those different kinds and types of markers. And I'll say, like, in no way is resting heart rate as measured by my Apple Watch diagnostic of anything. However, me personally, in my own anecdotal case, if I see things start to jump up, I am going to wonder if I'm maybe taking too much levothyroxine and go have my, you know, I'll go to my endocrinologist and have it tested. Or, you know, now with Inside Tracker, that can happen. But so that's, you know, that's that. But it really is that interplay of what is in your family history that you know about. And if you don't have genetics, maybe you can ask these questions, or if you don't know your biological relatives, you can look at the genetics. But I know that I have a predisposition to gaining weight, type 2 diabetes mellitus, asthma, allergies, peanut allergies. I don't have one. My brother does. Elevated LDL, elevated cardiovascular disease, and certain autoimmune disorders like Crohn's disease and rheumatoid arthritis. Like, I know this about myself from my genetics. So that is my, you know, that's kind of my foundation that I can say, okay, here are the things that I need to be worried about. I know I'm probably an unlikely sprinter, which I think is what 23andMe told me a while back. I think they changed the language on that one, but I always loved it. It cracked me up because it's true. But that's, you know, that's the foundation. That's where I'm working from. But then on top of that, like, okay, well, what's going on? My HDL in the end is actually fine. It's always been fine. You know, my LDL's always been not fine, right? Nothing could have predicted this weird thyroid disorder, but I now know to pay attention to these types of things because of my Apple Watch. I know that I'll find out about age at menopause. But that's, you know, the kind of fourth data type that we're not talking about is actually what we call user-generated health data. And that might be, that's information from the person themselves and their own commentary on their health and where they are and what symptoms they're experiencing and tracking all of that information. So that is also important too. But, you know, I think that, I think I have like some elevated risk of having low vitamin B12, but my B12 is always fine, you know, but I might be worried about my B12, but I know that my B12 is okay. And every time I've had it tested, it's okay. So I don't really worry about that genetic risk anymore. So this interplay, it just helps, you know, we're not one dimensional. we're so complex. And different layers of different types of measurements and their associations with each other, it just helps to kind of paint a more high resolution picture of what your health state is at that moment in time. And that's where it gets to be really helpful. And you want different colors to create that picture, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And just for the audience to understand, the risk score that the genetic score providing, it's usually pretty small. It's not 50%. It's usually in the single digit to, I don't know, 20%. So even if in the Renée's example, she have a high risk for a low B12, most likely she won't have a low B12. So that's why it's important first to see your risk and then test it with a blood testing and understand whether the risk become true. Right now, it might come true for Renée when she will be at her 80s. Mm-hmm. So that's why you need to continue and test. And I have a risk for a low B12. I should test my B12 and try to find when it started, the risk become a reality. So I think that's a good way to combine it together. And as we discussed before, we are trying to look into adding a DEXA scan. We are looking into adding some understanding better what food you consume and what macro and micronutrient. So there will be a lot of additional input to allow women, but also males, to understand the body better and hopefully live longer and better. A question about, what can we do related to lifestyle for hormonal imbalance for women? Is there any intervention that is more lifestyle, or it's literally something is wrong, let's go and talk with your primary care physician?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think we would always recommend you go and talk with your primary care, even if nothing is wrong, but you know that you're, let's say, in the age range or even experiencing one of those symptoms, or like I said, you're not even experiencing the symptoms, but you're kind of there age-wise. But on top of that, you know, we do have recommendations for sleep disturbances and vasomotor symptoms that are vitamin E, sage extract, black cohosh, red clover, cognitive behavioral therapy that helps you, you know, I will poorly explain it by just saying like it, CBT can help with sleep hygiene. Sleep hygiene is like it's the real deal. Yeah. Mine is terrible. Yours seems to be incredible from what you tell me. We should all like sleep like Gil, or have sleep hygiene like Gil. But
yeah. I'm trying.
Yeah, I'm failing. But you know, those are all things that have kind of passed our bar for what we call recommendations or advisories. And you know, I will say it's like one of the things that I really. What I really like and about the team at Inside Tracker and the you know the system that is at Inside Tracker, it's really let's look at all of the published literature about you know topic X, and that might be the impact of sage extract on vasomotor symptoms for women in menopause, and they'll say, okay, well we looked at. And I'm not remembering this correctly, but let's say 6 different studies and 3 of them showed a positive impact of sage extract, on those symptoms. And probably for this one, it was like self-reported, you know, women took sage extract and they, you know, reported whether or not their symptoms improved or didn't, because we don't really have like a biomarker that we're measuring for vasomotor symptoms besides like how many hot flashes do you get in a day and how often do they happen. But, you know, and maybe 2 studies didn't really see an effect. And there are lots of reasons why you see or do not see an effect. Studies are super complex. Everybody wants everything to be black and white at all times. And they also, you know, want personalized nutrition. And it's really hard because science is complex. Research is complex. Biology is complex. Biology changes over time, of course. But from our systematic review, those were some of the interventions that did meet our criteria.
Yeah, and one more point that you mentioned at the beginning of the discussion is that historically we done much less studies on women. So the environment or the universe for studies on women is very limited and it's tough, but we could come and say, okay, we'll do nothing because we don't have enough data, or we can come and say, okay, let's use the data that we have, the best data that we have, and let's add more data and hopefully publish some paper on the data that we are collecting. And again, that's what we are trying to do here at Insta Tracker. I want to, based on your discussion, to maybe let's spend a minute or so about the team that done it. The team, the scientists, the great scientists in your team that worked hard in the last few months to come with this amazing, I'm excited to say amazing, a new panel. So can you describe them a bit? Who are they? What have they done? What excite them? Can you describe it a bit?
Yeah, I mean, they're all huge nerds, and I love that about them. And I'd say the other characteristic that I can say is they are all super committed to scientific integrity. So, you know, the quality of the work that they do is very high, right? So they really want to make sure if they're investigating a scientific question that they have found all of the papers on that topic and they have read all of the papers on that topic. And then after they do that, they form some opinions about how we can use this information or not in our product, and then take that to the broader team and then discuss that with the broader team. So all of that happens before anybody sees anything in the product. And that is incredible because to me, like I don't have a nutrition background, right? Nutrition research is like, there's so much of it. A lot of times the studies are kind of small or they're associative, or, you know, it is a really complex topic. And what I need is somebody that has more experience than I do reading and interpreting that material and then giving me their hot take on it, right? And I can't tell you how many times like I abuse my position or my employee status at Inside Tracker and ask the nutritionists and registered dietitians to comment on like this or that I find on the internet, right? Yeah. Because a lot of times it's very hard to weed through misinformation. It's very hard. So just knowing that you had somebody that did a systematic analysis that has the expertise to do that analysis, read through everything and come up with, you know, a conclusion is incredible. So that's why I'd say, you know, they're very interested in the topic, super eager and willing to learn on a new topic that they may not be as familiar with. A lot of, you know, scientific integrity. And, you know, you'll hear it. We'll push back and be like, no, we need more time to do this and that because it's hard and we want to make sure you do a good job. And like a real dedication to the public, you know, whether they're Inside Tracker customers or not, yeah. It's just like a real commitment to information. And that goes beyond, you know, just the science team, because there are scientists in other parts of the company.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I want to add that they push us very hard to push this women panel and develop it. And I think that that's great that not everything should come from the top. Also, think should come from the team and what they believe that is a good service for humanity. So absolutely, I want to echo what you said. And also thank everyone that work very hard and to bring this amazing panel to life. We know that a lot of people are going to Dr. Google or now maybe a ChatGPT and asking a lot of questions. And we know that sometimes the answer is not the right answer. So I would like to ask you a bit about that related to women health and specifically misinformation that you can find at Dr. Google or ChatGPT. So do you have any anecdote that you would like to share with our audience?
Yeah. So one thing that was, you know, maybe surprising to some folks was that we actually looked very deeply into whether there was a relationship between soy consumption and the three new biomarkers that we are testing, so TSH and estradiol and progesterone. And soy was actually null, which means that there was information out there, but it either had no effect or had a very conflicting effect where you couldn't really make a conclusion either way. So soy was actually null for a relationship with those biomarkers. I think that might be a surprise to some, especially they might have expected to have seen a relationship between soy and estradiol. Soy is a phytoestrogen, and they are what we call weak estrogens. But compared to estradiol, like estradiol is absolutely going to grab onto that receptor and bind to it and hold on to it. And so much more than a phytoestrogen. So I do think that for folks that are taking levothyroxine, there can be an interaction between soy and levothyroxine itself or the drug, so that you might want to avoid eating soy at the same time that you're taking your medication. But other than that, there's really no relationship between those two, between soy and the three biomarkers.
Thank you so much for providing this information. And again, I think that it's a good lesson for our audience. Don't believe what is written on Google or even a ChatGPT, and try to come for places that you have a real scientist that researching the data and vetting it very hardly and providing only recommendations that are pretty strong. So thank you so much for that, and also thank you for so much for sharing it. So Rene, another interesting point, and again, I discussed it in the past with Jennifer Garrison, but also with a few others, is the HRT. Mm-hmm. And it's like a bit like a coffee. So one day it's good, one day it's bad, and the other day is I don't know. Can you make some order in HRT and allow our audience to understand what is, at least what is the viewpoint of the scientific medical community today?
Yeah, I think the viewpoint today is really different from a couple of decades ago when the Women's Health Initiative first published their results. So, you know, just to dive back in this, and, you know, others would understand this field and know this field better than I, but the Women's Health Initiative was a very large study that looked to assess the impact of hormone replacement therapy on women and their risks of various diseases. And one of the reported outcomes at that time was that in one of the clinical trial arms, there was a reported significant but very, very slight, modest link between, but it was statistically significant, between estrogen and progesterone and so hormone replacement therapy and then breast cancer. So, and then this, I think the media kind of took this and ran with it. And, you know, this was before we had names for sensationalist headlines like clickbait, but I'm sure it was clickbait, right? And the problem is that then it really kind of demonized HRT, and doctors became afraid of it. Patients became afraid of it because they didn't want to increase a woman's risk of breast cancer. However, the study itself had a lot of challenges, and some of them were very understandable challenges because it's hard to run studies like this for practical reasons. So things like the study population was actually fairly, there was a large distance between menopause and when these women were in the study. So I think the average age was 65. And if you think about, like, the average age of menopause at 51, that was one thing. The second was that a lot of women in the study didn't actually experience a lot of menopause symptoms. The third was that they had a lot of comorbidities as well. And those comorbidities are things like cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes mellitus, like dyslipidemia, metabolic syndrome, things like that. And so those are very complex confounding effects that are just jumping in there. Lastly, they used pregnant mare serum estrogen and not like a human biomimic estrogen. So really like an estrogen that we're not prescribing right now. And I think there were some differences in the progesterone that was used as well. So you know, the challenge here is that by not prescribing hormone replacement therapy, it meant that there were a lot of women undergoing very severe symptoms during menopause that were not experiencing any relief of this. And, you know, there is also some evidence that around the menopause transition and after that, that women who are given hormone replacement therapy, there may be cardioprotective effects, because we know that estradiol, like, even though it's been weirdly demonized, it in the right doses really has a lot of beneficial effects, like maintaining skin elasticity and you know, improving your lipid profile and you know, other, you know, kind of longer range age related disease risks. So, you know, that's another reason why I think I mentioned this before, why I wanted to talk to my doctor about HRT, because I also don't have a history of breast cancer risk, but these are the types of things that, like, your PCP can go over with you. But, you know, estrogen in and of itself, you know, isn't there's no, like, it's not a known cause of breast cancer. But of course, if you have a hormone receptor positive breast cancer, it means that, like, those cancer cells have estrogen receptors on them and progesterone receptors on them. And then if you have estrogen and progesterone in the system, they can bind to those and, you know, cause a handful of downstream effects, like cause that cancer cell to proliferate. But that is a really kind of, that's a unique scenario, right? For women that either have an elevated risk or actually have breast cancer, right? So, you know, no. Would you give estradiol to a woman with breast cancer, with ER-positive breast cancer? Absolutely not. But nobody is doing that. So I think that right now the medical community is, like, really shifted, and they're taking kind of a different look and saying, like, okay, well, we're talking about giving HRT to women in order to mitigate their symptoms. And that, just from a quality of life standpoint, is real. And then even beyond that, looking at it and saying, like, hey, this might actually provide some real benefits for women in terms of diseases of aging and, you know, elevated risk after menopause. So,
Yeah, and I, what I know, and I know little, is that currently the dogma is to provide it during the transition just to decrease the hot flashes and all the other side effects, and later on maybe wean the women from for the HRT. But again, I agree with René. Go and talk with your PCP and make an educated decision. But definitely it's not bad. It's something that you need to discuss and see if it's a good fit for you specifically. Usually, I tend to finish the discussion with a question. One point that or one recommendation that you have, René, for our audience: how can or what do you do or what would you recommend for someone to do in order to live better, longer?
Yeah, I mean, we could take another 17 hours to talk about this, and I know you just said one, so I'm going to pick this one, which I think is really important. I know I've said it before, but I will kind of like beat this dead horse. Just do a little bit. Like that's all. So I think one of the challenges, especially in like our world of health span, right, is it's really easy to listen to a podcast and hear about, you know, the optimal protocol for health span. And that optimal protocol, like I would definitely need to quit my job and maybe like eliminate my children from my life, except that part of that protocol is like having good family connections and friend connections and pet connections and all that kind of stuff. But you know, what I'm saying is that like to do it perfectly can be really overwhelming. And there's like a lot of, you know, oh my God, if you did not get in an infrared sauna today, like you've completely screwed yourself. Like you might as well just order that gray flop right now, you know, and that's just not the case. Like it is a marathon. It's not a sprint. So my recommendation, and I don't feel like I am an expert on this, but it's maybe how I try to treat myself, is with a little bit of kindness to say like, all right, Renee, for example, I have a night cheese problem. We always talk about this at work. And there's like a really wonderful sketch from 30 Rock where like Liz Lemon just eats night cheese. Anyway, look it up. We can provide this in the show notes, a link. But around 1 o'clock in the morning, and I have noticed from wearing a CGM that my blood sugar does drop around that period of time, I just love some cheese and crackers. Like if I'm still awake, or even sometimes if I wake up in the middle of the night, I'm like, I would just like some cheese and crackers. It is not the best thing in the world for me. You know, is it going to kill me? No, but I am proud of myself anytime I wake up and I do not have night cheese. Right. So like it's that one thing, that one thing. I did not have night cheese last night. Good job. I may have night cheese tonight. That's cool. But if I go from 7 nights of night cheese to like 5 nights of night cheese, that is important. So like I say, tuck in movement wherever you can. Like do squats while you're grilling vegetables, or, you know, any little thing, get up and move in a long meeting. Like any little thing that you do that was better today than yesterday, like applaud yourself for that. Then you can build a habit and like start with the things that are easy for you.
Yeah, so if I'll try to summarize what you said, is first know what are the issue, or what do you do that you are not supposed to do. And again, we are not a robot, so we are doing some stuff that we shouldn't do. And most
Speak
of us
for yourself.
And most of us know that we do some stuff that we shouldn't do. So first know it. Second, try to come with some, I don't know, some plan. How can you fight it? And fight it as much as you can. And don't be too frustrated if one night you ate a cheese and cracker. That's okay. Don't do it every night. That's a good summary?
Yep. Okay. 6 nights is better than 7 nights.
Exactly. And 5, you are even better. Excellent. René, it was a great pleasure to having you with us and discussing your history, and also providing so much intimate information about you and about your body. I think that it's really a great service for humanity what you have done. And I would recommend everyone to follow Longevity by Design. And if you are interested in our episode, please go to www.insidetracker.com/podcast. Again, thank you so much, René. And Hopefully, we'll host you again and discuss a new exciting development from InstaTracker soon.
Cool. It was my pleasure to be here and an honor, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by InstaTracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit InstaTracker.com/podcast.